Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of the You Should Run podcast. My name is Tony Heil. I'm the council member in Bridgeport, Pennsylvania, which is near Philadelphia. And like everyone else in the world right now, I am in my house. Well, they're not in my house, but I'm in my own home. And quarantined with the COVID-19 outbreak. I hope everyone that's listening is being safe and healthy and taking the precautions necessary. And this time is also a time of connecting with friends, meeting new people virtually. And I think for me personally, after doing this podcast, caring about people who are putting good governance and good leadership first. And so today, I've had a lot of different people on my podcast. When it's been people who are judges or running for judge, people who are state legislators and members of Congress from all over the country. But this is my main guest. And I mean that literally, because my first guest from the state of Maine, Portland council member Spencer Thibodeau, is going to talk about his experience and talk about what's going on in Maine, what he's experienced there, and what's inspired him to run, and hopefully what will inspire you to consider running for office in 2020, 2021, and beyond. So with that little bit in there, Spencer, thank you so much for taking time today to talk on my podcast.
Hey, Tony, good morning. Thanks for having me, and it's good to be your lone main guest. And I, like you, am kind of sheltered in place. And I mean, when you talk about things that make you get involved and run for office, certainly a pandemic is not something that you think you're ever going to interact with.
No.
And the learning curve has been an interesting one, but I think we are all starting to get it here, and we're starting to flatten the curve.
Yeah, I'm feeling somewhat hopeful because our state in Pennsylvania, some people have said that we peaked a few days ago, though by the time this is recording is up, that may have been a few weeks ago. I go through a wide range of emotions, as I think everyone does, from worry and anxiety and hopeful as well to usually I get very angry from around 5 o'clock until 8 o'clock when this guy goes on TV and says a lot of crazy things.
It's been wild. And, you know, I think this is kind of the importance of learning locally and why I was really excited to run for office in 2015. I am I'm the quintessential Obamaite, as it were. I was an Obama organizing fellow in New Hampshire, caught the political bug early. And so I slept on this woman's couch in New Hampshire. Her name was Joan for the entire summer during 2007. And the rest is history. Made it down to Washington to work an intern for a congresswoman from Maine. And then went to law school because of the Great Recession, which, you know, we may be heading into another one here. And then ultimately made it home. Look, I decided to run for office because of something that seems so small in today's age. In 2015, the issue was sidewalk clearing. And so in Maine, just as in Pennsylvania, we get quite a bit of snow. And I was walking to work, a new attorney here in Portland, Maine, and was walking in the middle of the road because the sidewalks weren't plowed. And I knew nothing about who represented me on the city council, knew nothing about, Portland politics just generally, and started talking with people about that specific issue. And my frame of mind is, if we can't do the little things, then how could anyone expect us to do some of the big things that at that time President Obama was challenging us to do? So I did what every 27-year-old does, and I ran for office. And got lucky. The incumbent actually retired and left an open seat. And so I was able to win in a three-way race. And I'm proud to say, at the end of my first term, kind of the bookend of that was that I got to rewrite the snow clearing ordinance and put additional fines and penalties for people who don't plow their own sidewalks as we're supposed to be doing.
So to pull back a little bit, you went to volunteer for Obama's campaign in 2007, you said, like in the primary?
Yeah.
You must, were you still in college then?
I was still in college. Yeah, I was probably, I think I was 20 mm-hmm. at that time. So 19 or 20. So it was definitely a different time. I mean, when you talk about just how things have changed in politics over the last 12 years, I mean, everyone was so hopeful, right? We had just come out of, you know, George W. Bush's term. People were angry at the administration. People were searching for something new. There was this charismatic candidate, right? Young family in the White House again. And you fast forward that to 2016 even, and just the complete mistrust and distrust in government and its ability to perform for ordinary people has been just unbelievable to watch. And I think with the current administration, you just see it continue to disintegrate, which is just really too bad. But that's where local leaders like you and I step up to the plate and represent our communities.
With all that's going on with the COVID-19 epidemic and the tragedy of both loss of life and livelihoods, people have been pointing out millennials as there's always the older generations, and not to pick on old people, who always say, oh, the young people aren't engaged, they are lazy, entitled, whatever. But people are younger than me, because I'm going to be 40. They have gone through so much trauma. You had this very hopeful experience with working for the Obama campaign and I did too in a way, but from 9/11 when you're young to the financial collapse to this, you can't go 5 or 7 years without tremendous challenge.
Right. And I think and to your point about kind of that criticism on the millennials and, you know, what's after millennials? Is it generation X or Y or whatever it is, right? I think that criticism is interesting. I mean, what we have to remember is in the next, 4 years, we'll step into that place where we're the largest voting bloc, right? Mm-hmm. We speak the loudest. But you got to remember, the people who are learning in hospitals right now, who are stepping up to the plate, right? They're folks who have, like my mom, who's been an ICU nurse for 20 years. But they're also young people newly out of college, just, got their nursing degree or just started as a resident at a hospital. And they're on the front lines. And our generation, millennials, right, are about to shape the next generation. And then you've got this new, generation watching who are in school right now, and one can only imagine what their world is going to look like, right? A classroom with, nonstop, Lysol wipes, face coverings, things you and I never had to deal with I've never had to deal with for my 32 years of existence on the planet, right? So, I mean, there's a lot of change coming at this generation, and I think we look at our iPhones, we expect our iPhones to work immediately when we tell them to do something, right? Or we act, or we press an app. We expect government to move just as nimbly, and I think what people realize is government in this century is not set up to do that quite yet, and I think that's going to change with a new generation of leaders.
Yeah, I saw that in New Jersey recently, because they were having issues with the unemployment claims and getting the systems running, and they needed new programmers who could type in the COBOL language. And yeah. People were like, nope, no one does that. That's not... Some people were able to apply from other states even, I think, because that's... The government was working on programming language that was so old, but I'm sure part of that is because people in government, rightly or wrongly, never made it a priority to upgrade it because it costs money and time.
Well, and that's exactly it, right? I mean, you look at court filings, right, and local jurisdictions, notaries, right? Like, I'm a real estate attorney. Trying to find someone to notarize a document in person today, is an impossible task, right? And so there is some change that will come out of this moment that will be positive that will shape the next, 15, 20 years, right? Kind of accelerate investments into kind of mobility and ease of use. But we also have to remember is it also increases this kind of isolation effect, right? That social media has started, right? So, the concern for younger people, younger than 32, right, is they spend too much time on their iPhone, they're on Instagram, they're getting, that feeling of being left out, right? They're at home instead of being outside. Those are the general criticisms. But our society, based on this pandemic, is starting to move that direction, right? And so how do we maintain that personal touch while at the same time investing in advances that make government more efficient and more nimble?
So you said that you decided to run for office, to run for council in Portland, which I imagine is very different from the other Portland. Do you guys get like attention like every once in a while? You get on a Zoom call now because that's all anyone does and just talk about which Portland's the best?
I mean, there's really no tension when you're first, right? Yeah. And so, I think when, I'm sure people in the other Portland might feel differently, but for me, I was out in Portland, Oregon a couple of years ago, and I don't know whether this is true or not, but what they told me was the way that they came up with their own name was that they had a vote on this between Portland and Boston, and Portland won. And so I like to think that we help shape that city as well.
Well, Boston, Oregon sounds stupid. So I'm glad it just doesn't make any sense. There's a port over there.
It's not as if Portland, Oregon is like on the ocean. I mean, I'm Portland, Maine, I've grown up my entire life within 5 minutes of the ocean, right? In any direction I pretty much go except for west. And so Portland, Oregon, you're on the Calumet River. And so you're not really on the ocean. It's a port, but this is not Portland.
But you decided to run, like you said, because of a very local issue with snow plowing. When you did that, it's obviously in one way small potatoes compared to what you were campaigning on when you volunteered for a presidential campaign. But what did you learn through that process about like what government is doing, can do, or is incapable of doing?
I think what I learned is it's more difficult than we think to enact what we think is simple changes, right? Mm-hmm. And so the very idea of getting from an existing ordinance to a change in that ordinance after, a study, after kind of coming up with what, retooling operations citywide. I mean, the city of Portland employs about 1,000 people, and it's a city of 66,000. To move that ship, it's a smaller ship, right? It's not the United States government to try to turn that bureaucracy into action, but it still does take some time. So I think what Barack Obama taught us all that change isn't going to be easy. I don't know that when I was running for office, I understood that change was going to take quite as much time as it does, And so I think the outcome that people are looking for is that they're looking for immediacy. When someone calls you over to their home to look at, a sidewalk that's come in disrepair, right? They remember you showing up, but they equally remember if you don't fix it.
Right.
So I think that is the most challenging thing about it. I think the other issue, and I'm sure you run into this yourself, is limitations on your authority.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that is, people don't go to their state senator or their state rep to kind of get those really local issues done. Right. They go to you or your state rep or state senator direct them to you. And when they come to you, they have that expectation that you can execute. And that's the hardest thing, to tell people that you literally can't do what they're asking you to do, whether it's simple or not, mm-hmm. I think that is the most challenging part of the role.
And one of the other things I'm thinking of from when I went to a YEO conference is most people in public office, I would say most people, it's a part-time job or volunteer job even sometimes. And right. So you have another job, you're a lawyer, I work for a nonprofit. And so if someone calls me and says, there's this issue, I will call our borough staff, but I can't get there most of the time. Maybe you can because you might be able to be flexible. You got meetings. So, right. You know, I think people don't realize that this is, I mean, it's not a sacrifice necessarily, but it's not something where it's just an easy hobby to have on the side.
Well, you know, you ask yourself this question, right? Like, how did you have so much free time before you ran for office, right? I constantly think that, I really do. I wonder, I'm like, my goodness. I mean, you're at a meeting, you know, at least two or three times a week, if not more, right? And so it's like, what were you doing with all that free time before? Like, you were running, you were going out to drinks with friends, you were getting dinner, right? Like, those life things that you sometimes have to miss. But to your point about the opportunity that it provides, I mean, going to one of those YEO conferences, right? And, you know, sitting in on a session with like an Ilhan Omar or, you know, Julian Castro, right? Or Rashida Tlaib, right? Like having those connections and making those connections and understanding their perspective, I mean, that's an opportunity that not as many people as we'd like get. And so, you know, that's what constantly energizes me about being around other electeds, young electeds, is just the reminder that you're there working for something larger, and you may not always be working on the sexiest issue, right? The one that kind of gets your blood going, but an issue that is just equally as important.
Yeah, I agree. I think that from doing this podcast, I was telling my wife the other day, maybe I was telling someone else, actually, I almost feel very inferior talking to so many cool people from across the country. And I don't mean that as a dig on myself, because, you know, I don't go to council meetings three times a week. I have a borough of 4,500 people. So my responsibilities are usually smaller than yours. Most of the things we can do are via email. You know, we have multiple meetings a month, but not to the same extent.
Right.
Instead of putting that on me, I'm just like, wow, there are so many great people in places from Maine to Nebraska to Alaska and everywhere in between. And so that is inspiring. I think that, you know, if you look at the presidential campaign this year, there are people inspired or uninspired by the different Democrats who were running. Now it's Joe Biden, who I'm all in for Biden.
Great.
And nothing against Joe Biden, who I've met personally many years ago. But at this point, if it was, you know, just they pulled a name out of a hat, I would be inspired for them too. But I do like Joe Biden. But you have so many other things you can get inspired by with people all up and down the ballot this time that I think is different even from 2008 when you were first involved and everyone was all in for Obama.
Right. And that's the most interesting thing for me, right? We started out with, especially this go round, with what, 25 different presidential candidates, and we've narrowed it down to one, and it happened to be by some magic, right, the one that I started supporting, right? And it happened with Barack Obama. There were a few candidates back then. There were probably seven. But here we go again, right? And the goal, and what I think you've seen here, is a real kind of coalescing around Joe Biden, because people understand when they watch that, you know, 3-hour, you know, campaign pitch from the briefing room, you know, between 5 and 8, as you said, and they just see, you know, someone who is unqualified to be president, right? And so I think the really interesting thing is you have this refreshing moment where you have someone who's been in that room before, who has promised to act as a bridge to the next generation. And I'm just super excited, like you are, to see who his VP pick is going to be and how that's going to impact policy going forward. But you and I both know, right? The challenge is not the election. The challenge is, what does the election look like? I mean, we can't, you and I can't even meet in person today. How are we going to run a campaign and get people out to the polls in this, you know, kind of new coronavirus world?
Yeah, and I was looking at your background. I know you worked for Shelley Pingree. You have experience working with other elected people, including on your council and in Portland. You know, when I was looking at candidates, whether it's for president or for other things, I look now less at ideology, though ideology is important. I prefer a progressive candidate, but right. I look at who is making promises that are plausible, and I look at competency, because I look at people who will understand, no, the office of this office, whether it's president or mayor, can do this, and here's how I can do it. Like, okay, they get it. They can start and they can do the job. That, like, I have a different perspective of it than I did before I ran for office.
Right. I you know what I call that? Is I call that kind of the pragmatic progressive, to be honest. And I think I fall within that as well. I mean, there are policies I would love to see happen, right? I think the question is, at what level do we actually fight for those things? And then who do we elect to fight for those things, right? For me, I want to make sure if I'm not just telling somebody that I'm going to do something and then it never gets done. Like, I want to say, all right, what steps can we take incrementally to get there, right? Oh, right, the Affordable Care Act, huge step, right? Not exactly what Barack Obama wanted, but probably one of the greatest steps in healthcare in 75 years, right? And so if you think about what Joe Biden is talking about, right? He's talking about adding on, right? And getting to, you know, maybe something that isn't Medicare for all, but something that covers nearly every American, right? And that in and of itself is a huge feat, like, right? To get to that point, there's a little bit of luck involved, right? So, you know, that to me, that's a pragmatic progressive is somebody who supports the policies that progressives talk about, but also execute when they can, right? And get that, push that across the finish line to the best of their ability.
So you've learned a lot about how to get things done in Portland. I would be remiss if I didn't get to understand what's going on in Maine, what's going on in Portland. It's an exciting year in Maine.
Yes.
Especially for those of us who are not from Maine, maybe it's more exciting for us to watch it and be hopeful. So what's going on in Portland politics that you think we should know about, or just not maybe not even politics, but just Portland governing?
Most other cities find ourselves just before this pandemic in a housing crunch. We have, you know, our generation competing with our parents and grandparents to be back in cities. Cities have really come alive. They've got that built-in infrastructure. So the housing piece is just super important. We were struggling with a near zero vacancy rate on the residential side, right? And so, I mean, that is almost unheard of. We could not build housing fast enough. We've got wait lists for affordable housing, especially. And so that conversation, the national conversation about what government needs to be doing, is happening locally. We've had fights over minimum wage, which Portland increased before the rest of the state, and the state ultimately passed that to allow folks to get a raise. We've taken up paid sick leave, and the state actually preempted the municipalities from enacting ordinances and put forward, I think, a bold plan on paid sick leave that covered a number of folks. We still have a lot of work to do. I would say the biggest thing in Maine, just generally, as you and I talked about, is at the national level, and that's the Senate race. And so Susan Collins is up for re-election this year, and she's being challenged by Sarah Gideon, who looks almost certain to win the Democratic nomination here and take on Susan Collins in what will be the fight of her political life.
Yeah, I saw, man, I don't know what to believe in polls anymore, but, I mean, and I don't necessarily think they're inaccurate, but one thing that you probably have seen from being in Maine is that 4 years ago, or 10 years, whatever years ago, Susan Collins was extremely popular and respected in Maine, and now the polling here in April 2020 had her extremely unpopular, and it seems like there's a big shift there in terms of perceptions of, you know, what's going on with her and the reputation that she's cultivated during these few years of the Trump administration.
Right. You're seeing that. I mean, that there's a national push here, but there's, you know, I mean, starting with the vote on Kavanaugh, and then also just before that, the vote on the corporate tax cuts. Right. Those have really started to hurt her. She had kind of played this moderate lane for quite some time. One of her senators that she served with, Olympia Snowe, mm-hmm. she was kind of that, you know, Republican New England moderate, right? Your Charlie Baker-esque, right? And so you've got this interesting situation where Susan Collins is now what appears to be underwater from a favorability standpoint in Maine, and, you know, provided the election goes as goes forward in kind of any sort of way, taking out an incumbent is extremely challenging. You and I both know this, but I think Sarah Gideon definitely has a good shot, and she will give her a race. It used to be, and I'll finish on this, but it used to be that, you know, a good showing against Susan Collins was breaking that 40% barrier for a Democrat. I have to think that Sarah Gideon will break that, and if not win. And so it's going to be a closed race, but, you know, I think it will be very, very interesting race to watch for sure.
Yeah, we're hopeful. She better do better than 40%.
That's historic. I mean, you had a sitting U.S. congressman run against her back in 2008, I think it was, actually, and he came within, I think it was, you know, 15 or 16 points or something like that, but it really wasn't close. You know, that's an Obama year,
right? Well, it's obviously a lot's changed, so I'm hopeful that Sarah can get this finished. So you're able to pass some good legislation in Portland. You were inspired by the Obama campaign to begin with while you were in college, and you were inspired to run for office because of very local issues and learned what you could do. As we wrap up here, the podcast is called You Should Run. Why should other, especially young people, why should they be taking the plunge to run for office, whether it's this year or in the coming years?
I mean, I would tell people to run for office based on, find that issue, right? That one issue, big or small, doesn't matter what it is, but find the issue that needs fixing in your community. Because what I found after running was that it was more than just me that was concerned about issues like that one. And I think what you'll find as you kind of unravel the spool here is that there are a lot more issues like it. And so, you know, I'm now chair of the Sustainability and Transportation Committee here in Portland. And so I have oversight over, you know, all the sidewalks, streets, right? Parks, you know, and then also climate change, right? And so, you know, find that issue that gets you involved and keeps you involved. And without a doubt, right, your presence will make a difference. And so I tell people all the time, if you are upset, if you are motivated, if you have a little free time, as we talked about, you know, create a pamphlet, give it a shot. You never know what will happen. Even if you think you can't do it, you can do it.
I appreciate that. And one of the ways that people can do it is to not feel like they're in it themselves. One of the most important things I think in politics is to not climb the ladder and then kick the ladder out from underneath you. So if people want to reach out to you and learn your story, first I want to give a shout out to Ashley Van Orney from Iowa who connected us. She's connected me with a few different people on here and I appreciate it. But if people want to learn from you, how can they keep track of you, connect with you on social media?
Yeah, sure. They can follow me on Twitter, Spencer T from ME, always, you know, email me. If you just Google my name, you can find my email address, right on our city's website. It comes directly to me. And my cell phone number is there as well. But I'm always happy to talk people through. I've had calls from all over the Northeast about running for office, and I'm always happy to talk with people, and that's how it starts, right? For you, maybe for me, for sure, is that one person connected me to another person, and you know, about 1,000 coffee meetings later, I was sticking signs in the ground with my name on them.
I had a few less coffee meetings because there's not that many people in my town, but yeah, even more fun than me winning, though, at least or around as much fun, was getting other people to run and to see them win and succeed. And that's a real pleasure, is knowing that other people could do even more than you can.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
And you can be part of it. So thank you so much, Spencer. I wish you the best of luck in Portland, and please continue to be safe and healthy with everything going on right now.
All right. Yes, you too. Thank you very much. And thanks for having me. And big shout out to Ashley as well.
Right. And if you're listening, hopefully you will consider running for office wherever you are to help make your community a better place. Please listen to past podcasts. We have over 50 of them from over 30 states and growing. Thank you again to Spencer T from ME from Portland, Maine. I almost said Oregon there. All right. Thank you so much.